Now, it's no surprise to see George Galloway, the Member of Parliament for Glasgow Kelvin, praised on the cover of his new book, I'm Not the Only One, by Tony Benn, John Pilger and Ken Loach. But also one Daily Telegraph columnist, Frank Johnson, calls him the most eloquent left-winger since Aniran Bevan. And Sir Peter Tapsell says he is an outstanding parliamentarian, one of the few great orators in contemporary life. And in The Times, Rod Liddell, after a dismissive start, wrote of his book, as you read on, the horrible truth begins to dawn, which is, despite it all, George Galloway is right more often than he is wrong on the big issues. So why then was he kicked out of the Labour Party in the wake of the second Iraq war, forming his own party, Respect the Unity Coalition, George Galloway? George, let's trace this interest of yours in the Middle East. The real story starts in 1975, when you were 21, already 8 years in the Labour Party. You were alone in the Dundee City Labour Party offices in Rattray Street, and there was a knock on the door. Why did that change your life?
I wouldn't normally have answered it, because we were next door to the Department of Social Security, and there was a steady succession of hard luck cases always at the door. And when I was in the office alone, I normally didn't answer it, but I did this time. And there stood a very handsome Omar Sharif lookalike, who introduced himself as the local Palestinian student leader, asked to see the leaders of the party. I said, there are no leaders here, but you can see me. And 2 hours later, I was a signed-up supporter of the Palestinian cause and have been for the rest of my life. And I don't suppose I'll see the free Palestine I dreamt of in those days. But nonetheless, it's been the cause of my life. And I've never regretted for a minute, despite the scars I've sustained.
There was a rather
involved in it.
Rather romantic sequel to that in 1999, when you were in Egypt, weren't you, in connection with the Mariam appeal, because suddenly somebody came out of the crowd.
Yes, that very man. I had not heard from him for more than 20 years, had assumed that he'd fallen in some battle somewhere. And then, in the crush of hundreds of thousands of people greeting the red bus that we'd driven all the way from Big Ben on its way to Baghdad, this whisper in my ear said, I am Saad Jabaji from Dundee University. It turns out that he'd given up politics and gone into business and become a multi-millionaire.
Well, he passed the mantle on to you.
Yes, so I did say to him, thanks very much, Saad. You're a multi-millionaire and I'm a heavily damaged British politician because of my association with the Palestinian cause.
But anyway,
it was nice to see him again.
2 years after that first meeting, you paid your first visit to the Lebanon in 1977, and in 1980, you twinned Dundee with Nablus, flying the Palestinian flag on the Dundee town hall. What waves did that stuff?
Well, first, it was the first Palestinian flag ever to fly from a public building anywhere in the Western world. And I'm rather proud of that. We were just ahead of our time. We brought the mayor of Nablus, who'd had his legs blown off by Israeli terrorists. It wasn't widely known then that there was such a thing as Israeli terrorists. And all hell broke loose. An ailing department store called Goldberg's, in which no one had shopped for a decade, closed its doors, made 60 people redundant, and blamed the twinning. Our other twin cities warned us that if we didn't break with Nablus, they'd break with us. And the entire board of deputies of British Jews came to the city centre and made a sit-down strike wearing striped concentration camp-type pyjamas. It was really awful. Somebody took a billboard along Hampden Park, the Scottish National Football Stadium, which seemed to read, No pub like ours in Dundee. But when the floodlights went on, the fluorescent P, L and O were picked out, and it read, No PLO in Dundee. And it lasted for years and years and years.
Let's move on to your intimate relationship with Saddam Hussein. You say in the book, in 1990, I was an enemy of the Iraqi regime. I'd purposefully never visited the country. There'd been no Arab ruler who I'd more mercilessly attacked and his bestial dictatorship. How were you misinterpreted? How could you be misinterpreted when in 1994 you were caught saying, Sir, I salute your courage, your strength, your indefatigability?
Well, I wasn't caught. I made a speech in front of a very large number of people, and the speech was to the Iraqi people as a whole. Somebody said afterwards that if I'd used the good old Scottish word use, Y-O-U-S-E, instead of your, Y-O-U-R, then no misinterpretation would have been possible. But if you saw the words before the ones that you've endlessly seen, you'd realize immediately that I was referring to the Iraqi people's courage, strength, and indefatigability. I described Saddam Hussein just a month or two before that in the House of Commons in Hansard as you've just quoted, the head of a bestial dictatorship. I wouldn't go in 2 months from that to slavishly praising an individual that I'd always opposed. My problem was this. I wanted to stand with the 23 million Iraqis who were not Saddam Hussein. And this reduction of a whole nation to one man, and then the demonization of that one man to the extent that every suffering suffered by the 23 million is therefore justified, is just simply immoral in my view. I'm against killing other people's children, whether they've got a dictatorship or not.
What on the second visit, you went miles down, apparently. How deep was the lair?
Well, I can say now, I refused to say at the time because I knew that the United States was looking to work out where he might be and how they could blow him up, and I'm against blowing up other people's leaders. But it was a very long way down. It took, by my reckoning, I didn't look at my watch for obvious reasons, but it took about 27 seconds for the lift to descend. So it was either a very slow lift or a very deep lair. And I went there and I asked Saddam Hussein to allow Dr. Blix back to cooperate with the inspectors and to get rid of their weapons of mass destruction. He looked me in the eye. He said, "We would not lie to you. We do not have any weapons of mass destruction." And I record in the book that I was disconsolate at this answer because I thought he's even lying to me. But it turns out he was the one who was telling the truth, and it was Bush and Blair who were the liars. And it's come to something when the leaders of the so-called free world are the liars and the dictators are telling the truth.
I like your thing on Bush. Bush didn't so much find God as he found the party of God, America's own Hezbollah, the militant Bible-belting fundamentalist of the Christian right. What about, there's a more odd thing about Saddam Hussein. I hadn't realized he had a passion for Matthias Rose.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether that puts him up or down.
I think it probably puts him down, though, as I'm on my way to Portugal after this show, I better not say too much about that. But yes, that was his tipple. Although he himself found God, like most of the Iraqi regime, after the 91 war.
One last question. I was fascinated by the little insight. When Rumsfeld was out of power and out of fashion, your friend Tariq Aziz was speaking, I think, in Boston. And what did Rumsfeld come up to in trying to sell?
Aziz spotted Rumsfeld at the back of the hall. He'd moved into private business, had Rumsfeld, after the right-wing government had gone. And he started to make his way to the front of the hall, bearing a huge sack. Aziz's security men got anxious. But it turned out it was a sack of saccharine, of artificial sweeteners, that Rumsfeld was now selling. He gave it to Aziz as a present and said that if Mr. Aziz found them pleasing, perhaps he could see his way to asking the Iraqi government to order a very substantial quantity of Donald Rumsfeld's artificial sweetener.
The living metaphor, eh?
Absolutely. Oh.
Well, there's the book. It's called I'm Not the Only One, and you're off to don't get into any trouble when you get to Portugal. Stay with us for now. You'll still have time to catch the train.